This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
There is a queer angle to every issue, and we will find it. Don't expect us to be nice. Don't expect it to be safe. And don't expect us to be politically correct. Nothing is sacred. We find the queer, profane, and cringeworthy wherever we can, here on Joy 94.9. Is nothing sacred? There's something
evolving. Hi there, Joysters. This is Jim, and I'm on Is Nothing Sacred, and you're listening in with us. And we've got a really big show tonight, jam-packed full of guests. We've got a scientist, and we've got a social activist, and we've got a...
An author. And yes, we've got lots of very exciting people to talk to. It's going to be very diverse, very jam-packed.
It is.
Get excited.
And we've got music from Victoria, because it's Victoria Music Week, so we've specifically chosen songs. And I hope, Brad Wolf and Michelangelo, you're listening.
Oh, that's the connection. I was wondering why we're playing Amanda Palmer. The mystery will be revealed.
The mystery will be revealed. Amanda Palmer guests on a Victorian song. And we want you, listeners, to text us in on 0427JOY949. So you can SMS us in on that. Or you can ring Robert on the front desk on 1300JOY949. Hello, Robert. Or you can email us on air at joy.org.au. And tell us what you think about the things that we're going to talk about tonight. But we're going to talk about advances in medical technology to start off with. And we've got with us in the studio Eileen Nguyen, who does some diabetes research. And you're a chemist, aren't you, Eileen?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming along. So you're currently doing chemistry research at the University of Melbourne, and you hear that you might have some good news for people with diabetes. And can you tell us a bit about your research?
Well, my research is on making an antioxidant treatment for diabetic wound ulcers. So it would be applied as a cream, and we found in preliminary tests that it does in fact heal wounds. So that's good news.
So why are people with diabetes more likely to get foot ulcers than other people?
So they think it's from some nerve damage and just general poor circulation. So people with diabetes tend not to, wounds tend not to heal very well or as quickly as people without diabetes do. So they think that because of poor circulation to like the extremities, so like your feet and your hands, you're more likely to get like foot ulcers, especially because you're walking on your feet all day.
And Eileen, you gave us, we had a look at some of the slides actually before we came in tonight. I was actually eating at the time, so it wasn't great.
I did give Steph a warning.
Yeah, sorry, she did give me a warning, which was a warning I did not pass on to my co-host.
But I suppose...
It just looked like diabetes ulcers to me.
But yeah, I mean, Jim, of course, would know what they look like, but I wasn't aware. And it is quite serious by the look of it.
Yes.
Very, very serious. And for those listeners who aren't aware...
Google it.
Yeah, Google it.
Don't Google it. I've Googled it to try and find less worse pictures, and no, they went.
Because what happens, listeners, is become as the wounds don't heal and the circulation is poor, they go gangrenous, and eventually people with diabetes have amputations at a much higher rate than... If you go into a rehabilitation ward in most Victorian hospitals, half the people in there are rehabilitating from a couple of major things. One are major car accidents and car traumas, and the other is diabetic amputations.
So it's very common, is it,
so
Eileen?
It's quite common.
Well, I think the statistic that I read was that 15% of diabetic patients will get an ulcer in their lifetime, and then 60% of those will get amputations. Oh, or I think 60% of all amputations is from diabetes.
Right. So what's the, other than amputation, which is obviously not ideal, what's the...
that's understating it.
Understated. So what's the current treatment for people who get these ulcers?
So I believe that you can get diabetes, diabetic socks, which help relieve the pressure off the wounds. So they are less likely to get infected. And then if they do get infected, or to prevent... to prevent infection, you can take antibiotics, of course. So, and I think there are more
intensive... treatments are mostly physiotherapy and improving circulation.
Yeah, I see, yeah. And I do believe that there are some more intensive therapies as well. Like you can have plasma and growth factors in, like, injected via, like, IV, and that will help... that will help heal the wound as well. But I think those are quite expensive. So our treatment would be a much cheaper alternative because we're using very cheap, commercially available, like, sugars that are, like, cheap to buy.
So for people who are listening, if they might have diabetes, can you tell us sort of what stage you're at with the project? When are they likely to be able to see this, being able to benefit them?
So the way that... like drug treatments work when and with current FDA processes, it takes quite a long time. It usually takes at a minimum of 12 years for any drug to go through because it needs to go through all of the testing on animals first and make sure it's safe, and then before it can be even go into humans. But I think with our treatment, because it's going to be applied as a cream, it will bypass a lot of those because there are much less side effects that you can get from a cream unless you're allergic.
That certainly sounds like good news. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And good luck with the rest of your research.
Thank you.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLB, TIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
You're with James, Kurt, Steph and Pat on Is Nothing Sacred? Joy 94.9.
Hello there, Joycasters. This is Jim. I'm here with Pat and James and Steph.
Full house. Team.
And we've got in the studio now a Joy standby. A Joy standard, really. Not just a standby, but a standard, and that is Daniel Whithouse.
Okay, I don't think it's a standby if we book someone in a month in advance because we really want them on the show.
Well, that is true. But anyway, he is here. Hello, Daniel.
Yeah, in any case, good evening all. And it is a packed studio here. This is the most packed studio I've had in a while.
And you've been on three times this week, you know. You were on last week and you were on Saturday Magazine and now here you are back again.
If it doesn't rain, it pours. And in this instance, it's a happy coincidence that I get to speak to, you know, everybody in the place. You know?
That's good because you cover the demographic, don't you?
I don't know. We'll let the listeners decide that. I wouldn't want to say whether I do or not.
All right, listeners, we want. There are a few people, Mr. Dumbphone, you better be listening. We want you to email in onair@joy.org.au or SMS in on 0427JOY949 and KPM you as well. Get on your phones now and tell us that you are listening because Daniel has pearls of wisdom. As usual.
And I'll be clutching them at various stages of the show.
Well, we want to ask you the usual questions, Daniel. What is the difference between gay community acceptance in city and country?
Oh, look, it's, I mean, there are many levels to that, but what I would say from my experience of talking to many, many people in every nook and cranny of the country, the difference between the city and the country would mostly be there's... It's almost like in the country, there's more of a rural spotlight. It's more intensified. So if people are going to be accepted in the country, it tends to be if they're making palatable contributions to the town. So if you're the town doctor or you run the post office or you're the mayor or something like that, people won't care as much about who you are. Whereas in the city, you can probably be a little bit more anonymous, get away with a little bit more and not have to be kind of high-flying and... you know, all the rest of it. So that would be the biggest difference. I mean, in the country, I mean, time and again, people will say, you know, and I think it's kind of funny for a reason when people say, look, I'm the only gay in the village, or I'm the only gay friendly voice in the village, is that sometimes it can feel like that, whether it is the case or not. And I know that, you know, in the places that I've been to, that's not the case, but it can certainly feel that way. And for people who are questioning or who are not yet out and still coming to terms with everything, that's the kind of stuff that builds pressure over time.
One question that I had when I was reading about your book, in which you travel around Australia, just for listeners who haven't read the book, travel around Australia speaking to queer people in communities. When you landed in a town, when you pulled up your truck and said, okay, I'm here, how did you find people? And were there any towns when everyone said, no, we don't have anyone like that? And how did you respond to that?
Yep. So driving around the country, most places that I arrived in, I didn't have any contacts at all. So I would rock up and I would Google youth services, police stations, hospitals, counselling services, and I would just ring them up one by one. And I'd say, hi, my name's Daniel, this is what I'm doing. Have you got 15 to 20 minutes for a cuppa to talk about this stuff? And most of the time they just go, you bloody what? or they'd say, sorry, we don't have anyone who does that stuff here, or we haven't seen, you know, hang on, we did 5 years ago, but he's since moved to the Big Smoke. So most of the time people got me in because they just go, I'm just fascinated that you're actually doing this drive. I'm just going to get you in for 15, 20 minutes to hear about it.
Have a look at you.
Have a look at me. Absolutely. Have a look at this kind of gay white boy, you know, skipping around the country talking to other gay white boys.
See what colour sequins he's got on his heels.
And if he pulls up in a bus with a shoe on top, because that's, you know, the Priscilla reference. But what I did, it was my goal over the course of a week that I stayed in places was to get five contacts who I'd sit down and have a cuppa with. And I found that five was like a magic number. By the time I'd had cuppas with five people, they'd given me lots of other names in the town, and then all of a sudden they started to crisscross. So this whole idea about the country network being warmed up by my arrival. So I was lucky in that there were no places where I ever exhausted my number of contacts to have a cuppa with. Now, that's something I say because that actually surprised me. There was no place where I ticked everybody off the list to have a cuppa with. Mm-hmm. So the fact that that once it got started, country community said it's about bloody time and they really wanted to chat about this.
And what were some of the themes that came up when in the people you were talking to?
Look, country communities generally talk about two things. The first being rural youth suicide and the fact that LGBTI young people are way, way overrepresented. And you know, along with youth suicide, there'll be things like self-harm and all those other health indicators that we don't want anyone to be scoring badly on. The second thing that they talk about is how young people don't have the opportunity to be themselves, and because of that, they move away to the Big Smoke. So, country communities will talk about the drain of young people and great people and talents to the cities. And so this was actually one way where they go, look, maybe this is part of it. If we can kind of look at this as an issue, maybe it might help us retain some people. I mean, and the interesting thing about that was that so many young people that I spoke to said, how come everyone tells me that in order to be, you know, LGBTI in the country that I have to go to the Big Smoke? Why is that my only option? I've got my friends here, I've got my family, I've got, you know, all these things I've grown up with, which are my reference points. I want to stay here. Yeah.
So for someone like me who grew up in St Kilda and has never lived more than 5 kilometres from the centre of Melbourne, what are some of the things that you wish city people knew, like in terms of stereotypes or misconceptions?
About
rural life and particularly being LGBT in the rural community.
Look, I think most people would talk about how it's different. A lot of people would probably start off, most of the rural young people I spoke to, they'd be quick to kind of go, oh, I suppose you must think it's really boring here, or, you know, maybe it's not like, you know, for all the rest of you in Melbourne and Sydney. But what I think comes through in their stories so strongly is all the great things about country life. So even in towns of where you've got a couple of thousand people, they'll talk about the connections that they have with their community. And, you know, where this came through was with, you know, people who moved to the Big Smoke and then they moved back. Mm-hmm. And they'd say, look, I moved to the Big Smoke, but what I realised is I might have a greater pull to get a boyfriend or a girlfriend, but what I miss is, you know, I miss that kind of that streetscape, or I miss the land, or I miss the way the sun hits the rock in a particular time of year, or I don't know what it is, but I just know that I have to be here. This place is in my blood. And the more I heard that, the more I realised that that was in every single place, every single corner of the country. And so for me, what I try and do is that rather than kind of talk about my observations, I like to recount the stories and about people's love of country life, and that they, again, the theme was, we don't want to leave this behind. We might have to, or we might choose to, but we don't want it to be this forced choice of the only way to be LGBTI is to move to the Big Smoke. Mm.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Is Nothing Sacred? With Pat, James, Kurt and Steph. Joy 94.9.
We're back on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9, and our guest in the studio tonight is Daniel Whithouse. Hello, Daniel, again.
Good evening.
And we've been hearing about the pink glossy version of life in the country from you tonight a bit, but I want to raise some issues because I grew up in the country. I grew up in a fairly remote, semi-arid outback town, and my experiences in the country were that I couldn't wait to get out, and I've never gone back, and I have no interest in going back to the country. I believe that the country is something that you, if you can't afford to fly, you drive through to get between capital cities. That's my definition of what the country is. And the only context that I've had with people from my country town that I lived in was suicide reports, or a friend who I bumped into on Facebook, who's a Sydney-based gay activist these days, who we were chatting away about our experiences in this particular country town, and his uncle, who was one of the first men that I played around with when I was exploring my sexuality, is now a fine, upstanding heterosexual burger and leader of the community and really anti-gay in the town. And I just want to know how many of those sorts of stories came out, and what sort of safety is there for people in country towns where people like that need to be outed?
There are plenty of stories similar to yourself. So when I gave you the...
I love the book, by the way, because it was so positive.
I think that the reason why I, like some people might say, oh, you're just, you know, putting a positive glossy spin on it, is that when I was asking people, I was very, very clear that we know a lot about the homophobia that LGBTR communities experience, because there's been a lot of evidence on that. What I was focused on was how people overcame those challenges and what they were doing about it, and how they, you know, what happens after homophobic violence and bullying and all the rest of it. So for me, the questioning led to all of those stories, all the positivity, where people would say, look, even though I had this crap experience, and I think if you read the book, you'd see that I had this, you know, this crap experience, or it was difficult, but here's what happened from there on in. You know, here's how I overcame that. Here's how I went on with my life. And I think that one of the things that people say is that the venom has dropped out of country homophobia compared to what it was 10 to 20 years ago. And that's by how people speak themselves, LGBTI people, because it's not about my assessment. But also, what one of the things I'm a bit worried about is that people would say to me, you know, often I'd go, look, it's not homophobic here because no one's had their head kicked in, or no one's been bashed to death lately. And it's kind of like, well, actually, there's so much more to it than that. Yes, I am glad that, you know, there haven't been any bashings or deaths lately, or that you know about. However, we do know that there are all these, we know there's a lot going on.
Daniel, we've actually got a message in. Great song choice. Also, was there a strong, any sort of theme that was coming from the young people around what would improve LGBT rural life, you know, when you went and did all those interviews? Is there some kinds of ideas, I guess, that what could improve it?
The this was a question that kind of haunted me as I drove around the country, because everyone was like, oh, is it a particular LGBTI project, or is it a thing in schools, or is it a group, or is it a helpline? What is it? Is it a website? The thing that I noticed, regardless of where I traveled, didn't matter what place I went to, there were examples of people who were thriving and surviving. So it wasn't like there was a town where everyone was going well or everyone was going shit. It was actually like there was really a tale of have and have nots. But I started to notice this interesting theme, and it kind of it's backed up by a lot of other things, like a lot of other, you know, theories and frameworks and all the rest of it would back up. And that is that basically if you have five supportive people around you, it provides kind of a buffer or a protective factor. So if you're kind of questioning, you're on your own, you're kind of still working it out, your health and well-being indicators aren't going to be so great. If you add one person, kind of gets better too. By the time you get up to five people in your life, something different seems to happen. And it's kind of like, and if you look at what the research says about young people, it says if a young person, pretty much we know young people are going to experience homophobia. Homophobia and transphobia is going to happen. It's how they actually frame that up in their mind. So if they're able to reframe that and go, actually, I've got some people around me who support me. I don't enjoy it, but it's your problem. It's not mine. And I have to work out how to, you know, cope with that. Their health and well-being indicators go through the roof. If they sit there and go, I'm on my own, maybe it's my fault, maybe I'm bad, or maybe I'm not okay, then we know that they're not going to be traveling well. So when I do talk to people and people go, well, what is it that you're going to do? It's about how can we create supportive environments for young people? And, you know, and I work a lot in schools or with homelessness services or with counsellors or, you know, even police. To give them some training, but it's all about how can you be one of those supportive people? How can you be one of those five? And how can you encourage those young people to seek out so they've just got more than one person that they're relying on?
And there is lots of great work happening in regional areas with groups like Way Out and Gasp in Geelong, and which is really great.
Victoria is sensationally lucky. I don't think people realise if you step outside of Victoria, the kind of infrastructure, even like not just the LGBTI stuff, the other infrastructure breaks down. You don't have the networks and the supports and the rest of it. There are, but what you do have in all of these places that I went to were people going, we just don't bloody know what to do, but give us something. There is people with big hearts and they want to know what to do, but there's also a lot of people who are scared of doing the wrong thing, who are scared of, you know, making it worse. And, you know, I said this before, but, you know, when I have someone in a mining town going, I feel like I'm the only gay friendly voice in the village, I'd love to stand up and do something, but the voice of homophobia is too strong in this town and I'm scared about what's going to happen with my job and, you know, my friendship circles and all the rest of it. You know, we have to realise that those people are out there. What are the messages that we can send to them, and how can we get more of those people, you know, hanging out together and doing some great stuff? And we know, like, and this is one of the reasons why I went back to Mount Isa a couple of times, is because that's happening there, for example. It's happening in a couple of different places, but it needs some investment.
But I think one of the great things about driving around Victoria is if you drive from here to Bendigo, for instance, through all those towns, Wood End, Kyneton, Malmesbury, and so on, and have a look at the number of rainbow flags that are stuck on the cafe doors and stuff like that, that's a pretty good indication that there's something going on in those towns.
We're going to go to a song now. We've got another local band, City Calm Down, with Pavement.
Before we go into the song, I just wanted to say, if there's anyone who is listening and is feeling a bit isolated, you can always call Lifeline on 131114. You can also call the Gay and Lesbian Switchboard in Melbourne. It's 9663293. And in regional areas, 1800 184 527. And thank you so much for coming along and talking to us. It's been really great having you.
Thanks, Daniel.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Is Nothing Sacred? With Pat, James, Kurt and Steph. Joy 94.9.
Hi there, listeners. You are on Joy 94.9. It's 21 minutes to 11 and we've had a pretty packed full show tonight. And we've
got three texts that have come in, which is very exciting. Firstly, we have Paul Lynch, who is a fan of the show. Paul says, truly a fan of the show, all yours. future a good fairy. Keep up the outstanding effort. Thank you very much, Paul. Glad to have a fan. Also a message from Sophie. Hi, Sophie. Very glad to hear you. If you would like to be greeted online on the air, you can also SMS us on 0427JOY949. We also have a message from Dean Beck. Jim, would you like to read out Dean's message?
Yes, Dean has said, that is right. He was commenting on the comment that I made about the journey from Melbourne to Bendigo with all the rainbow flags that are on all the cafes on the way up there. And he says, however, as the last 10 years of City Council surveys in Bendigo reveal, youth aged between 15 and 25 in Bendigo describe the city as homophobic and racist, and the council continue to do nothing about an issue that they have data on going back 20 years. Dean, I think you actually ran a program on this just recently, and perhaps it needs to be revisited.
I think if you're listening from the Bendigo area, this is a call to action to lobby, or I'm lobbying right now, lobbying Bendigo. I don't know what council that's in, but
moving away from Bendigo.
Should be doing something.
Yeah, moving away from Bendigo at the moment, we are going to be, we're chatting with Captain Starlady. Hello.
Hello.
Hello, darling. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you for coming on, Starlady. It's great. I watched with great interest the film that was made about your involvement in the outback communities, and your little foray into the desert with a pair of clippers and some bleach, which was a fantastic story, I thought. Would you like to tell us a bit more about what you're doing up in the territory and with remote Aboriginal communities?
Yeah, well, I've been working in with remote Indigenous communities for over the last 14 years, and for the last 6 years I've lived in remote Central Australia, touring around, delivering hairdressing and fashion workshops. And I can go travel from anywhere from 1,000 kilometres from around Alice Springs. So we're talking about some of the most remote communities in Central Australia, which is second or third or fourth language that people know. People are living very traditional lifestyles with very strong culture. Probably the more that I've gone along, the more work that I'm now doing with queer youth, Indigenous youth out in remote. I have a lot of young people, young gay, lesbian, transgender, sister girls and brother boys coming to my classes and coming and talking to me, and their families are coming and talking to me as well. And so I'm trying to work with them a lot more now. It's become a lot sort of stronger focus in my work.
There's a few of us in the studio, I should say, Star Lady. There's myself, Steph. There's also Jim and James and Pat. So you might hear a few different voices. But one thing I was hoping you could talk to us about is working with Aboriginal communities. Could you tell our listeners a bit about, I guess, the different cultural understandings of Aboriginal communities compared to non-Aboriginal communities of being LGBTI?
Well, I mean, obviously, there's so many different communities, and every community is incredibly unique. I travel an area where I go to at least 10 different language groups, and I think one of the big mistakes the government makes out here is to lump all the communities together as one, and they're obviously all quite culturally distinct. And I think some communities are having a more open approach to LGBTI young people and people in their communities, and are quite accepting of that. But obviously it depends upon, it's like anywhere in Australia, depends upon your families, and depends on, who you are and, where you are. But it's quite isolating for young people out here. And I think, some of the biggest hurdles that young people have and their families have is the lack of services and the lack of understanding from health services and youth services out here. And some of those services are being blocked by in some boards that, there can be quite a lot of sometimes in town saying things like, there's no such thing as LGBTI, Indigenous youth, or that's not culturally appropriate. Well, I think quite often, for me as a working on the ground with those young people and their families, they're always coming and approaching me and going, oh, we've got so-and-so here, person's, you know, gay, their sister girl, their brother boy, their families are talking to me. But there's no services, and there's a massive lack of resources and a massive lack of support for those young people out here.
Starlady, this is James here. Starlady, it sounds like, I suppose, some of the issues that you're uncovering, I guess, are similar to that of our previous guest, Daniel. Have you, you said that the communities that you go to are very different. Yeah. Have you found some are quite supportive, and then in others, have you ever felt, I don't know, have you felt threatened in any communities? Or has it been?
No, me personally. I mean, around the time when I was doing, you know, Queen of the Desert, you know, I came out to the desert, and these are, for me, the most welcoming, accepting communities I've ever been in. You know, I am so, you know, I'm really celebrated for who I am. I'm given a very unique position that's celebrated within the culture that's being created, you know, just for me, you know. I'm like Star Lady. Everybody knows me, you know.
You have a skin name too, don't you?
These communities. I've travelled to maybe 30 different communities around Alice Springs, and, you know, it's just been so beautiful. You know, I've come from, I'd say, I experienced much more homophobia in Melbourne and country Victoria than I do here in Central Australia. On Indigenous communities, I feel the most accepted. And being accepted, you know, it's given me that opportunity to step up and shine. But around the time of the Queen of the Desert, I began to realise that sometimes the level of acceptance I've got isn't the level of acceptance that maybe some young people have.
So, Star Lady, it's Jim here. You do actually have a skin name as well, don't you?
Yeah, my skin name's Noorai. And it's all about how you, your skin system's about how you relate to other people, like brother, sister, auntie, uncle, mother, potential husband.
And what does yours denote?
My skin name's Noorai.
So what is it?
So my husband's Jungle. I'm looking for it, but three choices. There's eight skin names, and it all the ones starting with N are ladies' ones, all the ones starting with TJ are men's ones, and my potential husbands, who I'm always looking out for. Jungle is his first choice. Jepurula is second choice, and Dapananka is third choice.
We'll be right back with you, Star Lady. We're just going to go to a few announcements. You are on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. The time is 13 minutes to 11.
To find out more about Joy 94.9, check out joy.org.au.
Is Nothing Sacred with Pat, James, Kurt and Steph. Joy 94.9.
Hi there, listeners. You're on Is Nothing Sacred, and we were talking to Star Lady. Hello there, Star Lady. You're still there, I hope.
Yes, I'm here.
I would like to ask you a question about those LGBTI youth from remote communities who do move to cities. I mean, I've lived in inner city Sydney. I lived in King's Cross. There were quite a lot of Indigenous kids in King's Cross who were often scowled at by the local Aboriginal people because they weren't part of their community, because they came from out of town and they were known as out-of-towners. And it's not that much different in parts of Melbourne. And certainly in Darwin, there are quite a few LGBTI young people, Aboriginal people from remote Indigenous communities. How do those kids maintain their links with their communities?
Well, I think it's incredibly hard when people either feel or have had to flee, you know, their communities to connect with, you know, with greater services or perhaps greater level of acceptance. And I know, I mean, sometimes when people leave, there are a lot of opportunities that they can have. And I've known people who've left and have become very successful. It's just sad when people do, you know, can fall through those cracks, or, you know, have a lot, you know, mental health issues or traumas that they might have suffered. Then it becomes very hard. And I think one of the most important things is to realise that this is going on. And how do we create the spaces for those people to know that they can return home? Like, how do we begin to work with those communities to deliver education and to deliver the services? And I think if we're, you know, in our you know, eastern seaboard, we really need to start looking and focusing in the queer community of how can we support young people in rural and remote areas and Indigenous communities, because they are not getting the support or focus that they need.
Star Lady, I would like to ask a little bit about, you were talking earlier about how you felt a lot more celebrated in the desert than you have ever been in the city and in regional Victoria. That's correct, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. I like to use the word celebrate because last week we played an interview with Suzanne Walters, who is a queer academic from the United States, Massachusetts, thank you. And we were discussing with her about the concept of born this way, and her theory is that it's a rhetoric that's easy but maybe not quite true. And we were discussing about, for the people who are in those rural communities, born this way must be a very, it must be really wonderful to have that. So is it for everyone, and especially being celebrated as someone different, being Star Lady in the desert, do you think that when people are saying, oh, you know, am I born this way or not, is it easier for them to listen to like rhetoric like that? Or do you think saying, no, you just, oh, who you are, and you'll be celebrated for who you are?
I mean, I'm just going to say the whole idea of born this way isn't, doesn't really, you know, it's not how people are thinking, perhaps, in the central desert. Those sort of messages and stories are, you know, aren't what sort of, you know, I think coming through. I think people are more, you know, it's much more traditional out here, and people might have access to that sort of, that story, that line that's coming through. I think some of the things that are happening in, well, conversations that are happening in remote sort of central Australia is people trying to perhaps reclaim some of the traditional perspectives before perhaps Christianity. Like, I'm hearing the first sort of conversations that people are having because, you know, in some ways there's been, because of colonialism and religion, there's been, you know, homosexuality or transgenderism didn't exist, you know, pre-colonialism. While now I'm hearing, you know, from people, you know, talking to their grandparents and grandmothers going, no, there used to be, you know, sister girls or gay or lesbian people out here, and you need, you know, people are perhaps going to try and reclaim that story, that, you know, cultural information before it's lost.
In fact, there are some anthropological studies, particularly those that were done by Faye Gale at Adelaide University, that suggested that a lot of those pre-colonial and pre-white contact gay and lesbian people were celebrated for their role in dreaming and spirituality.
Some of this I'm not, you know, I just know through my friendship with some people, especially, I think, you know, some of the really leading sister girls, and I mean the perfect person to, you know, to have a conversation about this would be, you know, Crystal Love, the Tiwi Island sister girl matriarch. And I mean, there's, you know, she's one of my closest friends, and she's told me stories about how there's photos of sister girls from the 1930s and 40s that they have there.
I want to find where these are. That would be incredible. That sounds amazing.
Yeah. Crystal, you know, I think she's a national icon and treasure.
Do you think she'd be on our show?
I'm sure Crystal would love to
Excellent.
Be on your show.
That sounds like a perfect thing. We are... Just got one more question.
I was just going to ask one more question because I know that you were interviewed here on Joy before the documentary about you was shown on the ABC, and I was just curious what response there was. Are you recognised more? How have people reacted to that? Has it made a difference to your life having that shown on national television?
I mean, I think I have, you know, the opportunity to speak out more, which I think is very important. I think, you know, there's a few, like, out here in the central desert, one of the things that, you know, that I noticed that, like, I spread that, we're trying to do campaigns to spread that resource and other resources on USB2 communities. And Queen of the Desert in particular showed about the cross-cultural relationships that I have with the, you know, with the Arionga community. And so I think it's, you know, that movie and showing it to other Indigenous communities, I think it helped break down the barriers between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and really celebrates cross-cultural friendships on an international level and national level, I think it's great to showing people and about, you know, the opportunities that we can, you know, learn from each other, Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples, and remind people we don't have to live in the inner city ghettos. There are spaces for out there in rural and remote areas where we can be celebrated. We can get out of the nightclubs. It's the only place we can shine, and we're real, and we can have real roles in communities. And I know that inspired people all over the world about the opportunities they might have. And also, bringing sort of, there can be such hedonism, I think, you know, in our community.
So and it's really about the diversity of humanity.
Real, you know, keeping it real, let's go out there and find, you know, about who we are and how we can change, you know, our communities and our cultures and give back to it.
Thank you so much, Star Lady, for joining us tonight. And have a wonderful evening. Thank you so much.
I will.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
You are on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. We're going to quickly go to some messages and we will be right back very shortly.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
You're with Steph, James, Kurt and Pat on Is Nothing Sacred? Joy 94.9.
You've been listening to Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9 and it's now 2 minutes to 11 and the studio has just been invaded by the lady and the tramp.
And, I don't say invade, lovingly filled.
That's right. They've filled up those spaces over there behind the panel and they'll be on in just a minute. But we've had a really big show tonight. Thanks, Steph. Thanks, James. Thanks, Pat.
And thanks a lot to Daniel Whithouse, Eileen Nguyen from University of Melbourne and, of course, Captain Star Lady. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.